ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 15th of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Sydney in mourning, tributes to the six people who died in the stabbing attack at Bondi Junction as police try to piece together what motivated the killer, Joel Cauchy. And tensions rise in the Middle East after Iran's direct attack on Israel. What are the chances of the conflict spreading?
I think that, ironically, is something that they and the Biden administration very much share. Both parties have been very clear over this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians that they don't want to see that conflict spread and metastasize in the region.
Residents in Sydney's east are still reeling from the horrifying mass stabbing that took place over the weekend inside Westfield Bondi Junction. 40-year-old Joel Cauchy fatally stabbed six people in the attack on Saturday. Locals and residents from all over Sydney are continuing to lay flowers to commemorate the victims. Alison Shaw reports.
As Tyron Whitehead opens his flower shop this Monday morning, it's far from a normal work day.
We're trying to console the customers, the people that experienced the situation at the time.
He's been selling flowers for decades, but today most of his customers are buying his bouquets to add to a growing mountain of floral tributes just a few short steps away from his shop.
And whether it's a funeral, whether it's a wedding, a birthday, a celebration, whatever. But unfortunately, this time, for the first time that anyone has ever seen it in this area, you know, a terrible tragedy.
Westfield Bondi Junction is only a few metres away from his store, and Tyron has been reliving the trauma of Saturday afternoon.
I thought it was a marathon run, but anyway. Then I saw the terrorised faces of all sorts of people running down the mall, and it was absolutely terrifying. For me, myself, I just feel sorry for the people that were involved.
Sydney is grappling with shock and grief after six people died in a mass stabbing at the shopping centre. Eight people remain in hospital, including a nine-month-old baby girl who is in a serious but stable condition. As locals walked through a sombre Bondi Junction, they shared with The World Today how deeply they're feeling about this tragedy.
I'm absolutely devastated, and I have to say I'm actually quite teary, which, and I also feel very vulnerable.
We were actually there 15 minutes before. I just so happened to let it leave, so kind of coming here and seeing the kind of floral arrangement and obviously seeing the families on TV kind of has really hit home, and I had a bit of a pit in my stomach all morning since seeing it.
I was really, you know, panicked because they were planning to go to Westfield to take my granddaughter to the playground at level 5. And I was like, my heart's pounding and it's, oh my God, where are they? And I was just, it was a horrible feeling. I was really panicked and I can't barely sleep until now. I'm still thinking about those victims.
This is crazy, you know. We're all feeling it. We really are, you know.
Many who visited the vigil shed tears this morning.
We just got out of it, you know, just minutes before it happened. So, yeah, we were shaking when saw on the news.
How would you sum up how you're feeling this morning?
Just sad. It could have happened to us.
Others were struggling to comprehend the tragedy.
Sitting down reflecting on it, it's like, should I have, like, locked her in a shop and run back in and tried to do something? I've actually been, like, contemplating, should I be doing medical training now, combat training, doing something that enables me to protect somebody else if another situation, even if it's just someone slipping and falling and hitting their head? You just want to help. I guess everyone wants to help if they can.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the country is in mourning.
This is a difficult time for our nation and for all Australians. And all Australians can relate to going shopping on a Saturday afternoon with their family. It should be a place without risk, a place where people feel safe.
The Premier, Chris Minns, encouraged those who were struggling coming to terms with the horrifying attacks to remember the acts of bravery, like the bystanders who grabbed bollards and chairs to confront the attacker and retail staff who helped shelter people.
Whether it was some young men that confronted this murderer mid-attack with bollards and chairs, or the actions of Inspector Amy Scott, who ran towards the attacker and without any question saved many, many lives.
The Premier says $18 million will go towards establishing an independent coronial inquiry into the attack. He says the government may look at reviewing mental health support in the state after police confirmed the 40-year-old attacker, Joel Couchy, had been diagnosed with mental health issues.
We spend billions on mental health every year, but if it's going to the right places, if it's spent in the right way, if the quantum is enough, will be the focus of our inquiry.
New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb says the attacker's mental health will be investigated by the coroner. She says another line of inquiry for police will be whether and why the attacker's victims were mostly women.
It's obvious to me, it's obvious to detectives that seems to be an area of interest that the offender had focused on women and avoided the men. We don't know what was operating in the mind of the offender, and that's why it's important now that detectives spend so much time interviewing those who know him, were around him, close to him, so we can get some insight into what he might have been thinking.
In Bondi, the outpouring of grief and support continues from members of the community who've been brought together under such sad circumstances.
I've always thought this suburb was just a hub where people came to and went out of, but now I feel that it has a real heart.
Premier Chris Minns says a permanent memorial may be set up at Bondi to remember the victims.
That's Alison Shaw reporting there. A federal court judge is delivering his judgment in former Liberal staffer Bruce Lehrman's defamation case against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson. Mr. Lehrman claims he was defamed in a Network 10 interview with Ms. Higgins, where she alleged she was raped by a colleague in Parliament House in 2019. The criminal case against Mr. Lehrman was abandoned due to juror misconduct, and no findings were made against him. After 5 weeks of evidence, Justice Michael Lee is still handing down his judgment in the subsequent defamation case. Our reporter Rachel Hayter has been listening in. Rachel, good afternoon. What has Justice Lee said so far?
Good afternoon, Sally. Justice Michael Lee has decided that even though Bruce Lehrman was not named in the interview Brittany Higgins gave to journalist Lisa Wilkinson, which was aired on Network 10 in 2021, in which Ms. Higgins alleged she was raped by Mr. Lehrman, Bruce Lehrman was identifiable in that interview. And because he was identifiable, he was therefore able to be defamed. And the defendants, Ten and Ms. Wilkinson, have to prove that the allegations aired in that interview are true. And the central allegation of this case is a rape. So the judge is ruling whether or not that allegation is true. But the standard of proof in this civil case, it's not beyond reasonable doubt, it's on the balance of probabilities. And that means, in simple terms, that the court is satisfied that it's more likely than not that Brittany Higgins was raped. And that's what the judge is deciding and telling us today. Justice Michael Lee, on deciding whether or not truth is a defence, is taking us through the credibility of witnesses. So he's looking at the credibility of Bruce Lehrman and Brittany Higgins.
Have there been any criticisms of witnesses or parties to this defamation case so far?
Yes. So Justice Lee has said that he's satisfied that in important respects, Bruce Lehrman told deliberate lies and that he has no compunction about departing from the truth if he thought it was expedient. He said to describe Mr. Lehrman as a poor witness would be an understatement. One of the examples of Mr. Lehrman's dishonesty the judge gave was his inconsistency in denying that he found Ms. Higgins alluring, saying that his attraction for her was just like the attraction he could feel for anyone in the courtroom. And Justice Lee said that he found that disconcerting and unconvincing. He also said that he's satisfied Mr. Lehrman made false representations about how Seven got material it used in the program, that interview that Bruce Lehrman gave to Channel 7, that exclusive interview. On Brittany Higgins' credibility, Justice Lee said he's conscious giving evidence would have been daunting and stressful, and that some of her unreliability was compromised by her mental state due to trauma. He said her conduct in 2019 was not inconsistent with the conduct of a genuine victim of sexual assault. He said that nuance is required when assessing Brittany Higgins' evidence. But he also said that in 2021, Ms. Higgins had established a broader narrative and that with the help of her boyfriend, she tried to develop an account that made her look better in the eyes of others, and that made her an unreliable and complex witness. This 324-page judgment is still being handed down. There was a long pause because of technical issues. The judge using interesting language saying that because of the unexpected detours and collateral damage of this case, it might be more fittingly described as an omni-shambles. And at that moment, the live feed cut out. It's now going again and that judgment is still being handed down, Sally.
That's Rachel Hayter. You're listening to The World Today, and remember you can also listen to the program as a podcast online. The United Nations Secretary General says the Middle East is on the brink of a devastating full-scale conflict and has called for an immediate de-escalation. Iran's weekend drone attacks on Israel has taken what's been known as a shadow war firmly out of the shadows and made direct conflict between the two countries a possibility. US President Joe Biden has told the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu that the US would not take part in any action against Iran. Rachel Mealy reports.
The late-night session at the UN Security Council was another forum for a fiery confrontation between Israel and Iran. The UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres urged maximum restraint.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
The call comes after Iran sent dozens of exploding drones and missiles to attack Israel. Gilad Erdan is Israel's ambassador to the UN.
This attack crossed every red line, and Israel reserves the legal right to retaliate. We are not a frog in boiling water. We are a nation of lions. Following such a massive and direct attack on Israel, the entire world, let alone Israel, cannot settle for inaction. We will defend our future.
He called for the Security Council to take severe action against Iran, including sanctions and condemnation, but stopped short of direct retaliation.
No more red carpet treatment here at the UN. No more appeasement. Today, the Council must take action. Condemn Iran for their terror. Trigger the snapback mechanism and reimpose crippling sanctions. Designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terror organization. Action must be taken now, not for Israel's sake, not for the region's sake, but for the world's sake.
In response, Iran's ambassador, Amir Saeed Iravani, told the council Iran has an inherent right to self-defense. He called out the US and its allies, claiming those countries did nothing in response to Israel's armed attack on an Iranian diplomatic building in Syria, where top commanders were killed.
At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
Israel strongly rejects claims it's committing genocide. Ambassador Iravani says Iran doesn't seek a war with the US, but if it's attacked, it will respond.
If the US initiate military operation against Iran, its citizen, or its security and interest, Iran will use its inherent right to respond proportionately.
The US President Joe Biden is believed to have told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu his country will not support a counterattack. At the UN, the US Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood said Iran would be held responsible for any further military action against Israel or its allies.
The Security Council must unequivocally condemn Iran's aggressive actions and call for Iran and its partners and proxies to cease their attacks.
That's the US Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Robert Wood, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. So how significant are the direct Iranian strikes on Israel, and could they lead to a wider conflict? Firas Maqsad is Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C.
They are unprecedented. It has never happened before that Iran directly struck Israel. Iran has a very well-established preference for using proxy warfare, Hezbollah in Lebanon, militants from Syria and Iraq, Houthi rebels in Yemen, to take the fight indirectly to Israel. So the fact that this is a direct attack definitely poses a danger and is a new threshold that's been crossed.
Why do you think Iran decided for a direct rather than a proxy attack this time?
Well, Iran has also been on the receiving end of several unclaimed Israeli attacks, targeted assassinations. Some have taken place over the past couple of years within Iranian territory, targeting its scientists, its nuclear scientists, and those working on its nuclear program. But others have taken place in Syria and Damascus. So there has been a dire need on behalf of Iran to reestablish deterrence, to thwart Israel, make it pay a price for these actions so that they don't continue to repeat. And so this time around, given the fact that Israel had practically flattened Iran's consulate in Damascus 12 days ago, the Iranian regime made the calculus, the decision that the attack had to be a direct one.
For us, there is obviously a strategic element to what has unfolded on the weekend, but there's also the matter of capability. We've seen what Iran is capable of, and we've seen Israel's Iron Dome defence system in action, and this combined defence from a number of forces, including the US, the UK, France, and regional allies as well. What does it tell us about the capabilities of Iran and Israel in this kind of situation?
Well, there's a lot of information and disinformation out there. But if it is true that Iran had to fire north of 300 projectiles, more than 100 ballistic missiles, and have 99%, according to Israeli sources, of them intercepted, it doesn't say much about Iran's capability. The fact that the defense was so robust, so multi-layered, not only just on behalf of Israel, but really the CENTCOM, the Central Command Area of Operation led by the United States. That requires the United States, Israel, but also some of these regional countries to work together to thwart such a complex attack. And so one of the big takeaways, militarily speaking, is the fact that this defensive operation proved highly successful.
Does Iran want a regional conflict?
I don't believe so. I think that, ironically, is something that they and the Biden administration very much share. Both parties have been very clear over the 6 months since the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians began that they don't want to see that conflict spread and metastasize in the region. The Iranians understand that they are in no shape, again, to take on the United States and Israel directly. They want to keep this contained and have it be an indirect conflict that continues to drag on.
That's Firas Maqsad, a Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. The second independent inquiry into Star Entertainment's suitability to hold its New South Wales casino licence is underway in Sydney. The probe was called after the state's Independent Casino Commission said that Star wasn't moving quickly enough to reform the business after evidence the company turned a blind eye to money laundering and poor governance at the board and management level. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the Star inquiry. Peter, good afternoon. Can you just explain why this second inquiry was established?
Well, hi, Sally. The first inquiry into Star concluded that the casino group had set up an inherently deceptive and unethical process to get its house in order. So a special external manager, Nicholas Weeks, was appointed to run the casino back in October 2022 as part of the reform plan. Now, given evidence that Star had not been managing its money laundering responsibilities properly, also dealing with so-called junkets to attract high rollers, and a board with their eye off the ball, the first inquiry took an extremely dim view of Star. So is Star suitable to run its Sydney casino? Counselling assisting the inquiry, Casper Conde, said that would depend on a number of factors, including character, honesty and integrity. Late last year, Sally, the corporate regulator ASIC, commenced civil proceedings against 11 current and former directors of Star, and so far Star has paid $150 million in fines.
And Peter, there have been extraordinary claims that Star's chairman had been spying on the special manager. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, Sally, these are certainly sensational claims about Star's sensitivity to the appointment of that special manager, the external manager, Nicholas Weeks. Counsel assisting Casper Conde referred to an email subpoenaed as evidence from Star chairman David Foster to the then CEO, Robbie Cook, that the company could have an opportunity to get rid of the special manager, Nicholas Weeks. Mr. Weeks told the inquiry he could only assume Star's managers had been spying on his diary ahead of a special meeting with New South Wales casino regulators. Mr. Conde read the contents of an email to the inquiry.
Okay, they are prepping for war. We better do the same. Should we talk to? And then there's a name of a lawyer from KWM. Do you see that?
I do.
Then the message continues, we are meeting Monday to get ready for war, though. First of all, these messages that I've shown you, Mr. Weeks, are all dated 31 January 2024, but you said your meeting was the next day on 1 February. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I expect that somehow they've accessed my diary, which the entry would have been in ahead of the 1 February meeting.
That's Star's special manager, Nicholas Weeks, being questioned by counsel assisting Casper Conde. That was our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, there. Finally today, we've been told that healthy living and keeping your brain active are some of the best ways to reduce the risk of dementia. But it could also come down to where you live. Research out of Melbourne has found that living in an area with green spaces and low crime can reduce your risk of dementia. Angus Randall reports.
Quitting smoking, staying fit, and doing Sudoku, all ways to reduce your risk of dementia. Your dementia risk could also come down to how close you live to a park.
So to see that green space or living closer to green space was associated with having fewer dementia risk factors wasn't necessarily surprising.
Associate Professor Matthew Parze is from the Turner Institute at Monash University. He studied more than 3,000 people across the country, looking at their local crime statistics and how walkable their suburb was. He found the further away you are from green spaces, the higher the risk of dementia.
People living closer to parks might find the time to go out and exercise more. They might find the time to go out and socialise, and being socially active is also protective against dementia.
There are many dementia risk factors connected to an unhealthy lifestyle. Smoking, heart disease and high blood pressure all increase your chances of dementia. Matthew Parze can understand why those in areas with poor green spaces and a high crime risk may decide against an evening walk.
You know, we can have messaging around things that individuals should do to reduce their risk of dementia. But if an individual lives in an area where it's not particularly attractive to go out and exercise, or there might be high crime in that neighbourhood and they don't feel safe, I think governments need to consider, well, what things could they do, what policies could they implement to make it more likely for people to go out and actually take some ownership for their health and do the things we know are beneficial.
Last year, a study of nearly 62 million older Americans found green spaces could reduce the risk of dementia. The link appears to be clear. So what can we do about it? Eva Ritchie is from the Green Space Alliance in Western Australia.
It should be connecting spaces. So, you know, parks that go from one cul-de-sac through to another cul-de-sac, if you like. Somewhere that they connect through. You're in a community, partaking with other people. It's like all of us. We're supposed to be connected. It's as simple as that.
She says in her experience, wealth remains a major barrier.
I come from Perth, love, and the western suburbs are all beautiful and green and lots of trees and larger blocks and all of that, you know, and then you go out into the outlying lower socioeconomic areas and we've got no water, you can't irrigate because, you know, it's, you know, 7 months no rain, you've got water restrictions and, you know, people are living inside their homes and not outside their homes.
Research shows 40% of dementia is preventable and keeping the brain active plays a major role. Associate Professor Michael Woodward is an honorary medical advisor for Dementia Australia and head of dementia research at the University of Melbourne.
It certainly seems to be that people know that if they keep mentally and physically active and eat a good diet, it's going to be helpful for their body in general. Their heart is probably the greater focus of attention, but the good news is generally what's good for our heart is also good for our brain.
That's Associate Professor Michael Woodward from the University of Melbourne, ending that report from Angus Randall. That's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was a warm, sunny autumn afternoon, and like most Saturdays, the Westfield Shopping Centre in Bondi Junction in Sydney's east was heaving with shoppers. Tragedy unfolded, leaving six dead. Today, a criminologist on what we know about the offender and the investigation to come. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listener app.